Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is on-air daily news for Friday, January 13th, 2023. I'm Naima Latif, and our top story is the tornado in Selma, Alabama. Crews worked through the night, searching for people trapped after a deadly storm spawned tornadoes across parts of the U.S. South, killing at least 8 people and causing substantial damage in the historic city of Selma, Alabama. One tornado cut a 20-mile, it's 32-kilometer, long path across 2 rural Alabama communities before the worst of the weather moved across Georgia on a track south of Atlanta. Searchers found the body after daybreak Friday while combing an area near a home that had been badly damaged Thursday when the storm hit central Alabama, said Autauga County Coroner Buster Barber. That death brought the toll to 7 in the county, about 40 miles at 64 kilometers northeast of Selma. In Georgia, a pastor died when a tree fell on a vehicle in Jackson, Butts County Coroner Lacey Prue said. The storm appeared to have knocked a freight train off its tracks in the same county, officials said. Ernie Baggett, Autauga County's emergency management director, said at least 12 people were injured severely enough to be taken to hospitals as crews cut through downed trees looking for more people needing help. He said about 40 homes were destroyed or seriously damaged, including several mobile homes that were launched into the air. They weren't just blown over, he said. They were blown a distance. A more comprehensive picture of the damage emerged Friday as the search for more victims, authorities said. The National Weather Service said late Thursday that suspected tornado damage was reported in at least 14 Alabama counties and 5 Georgia counties. In Selma, a city etched in the history of the civil rights movement, the city council met on a sidewalk using lights from cell phones to declare a state of emergency. The storm struck nearby Griffin, south of Atlanta, as mourners gathered for a wake at Peterson's funeral home. About 20 people inside the building scrambled for shelter in a restroom and an office when a loud boom sounded as a large tree fell on the building. When we came out, we were in total shock, said Shamika Pearson-Smith, the funeral home's chief operational officer. We heard everything, but we didn't know how bad it actually was, she said. The uprooted tree crashed straight through the front of the building, she said, destroying a viewing room, a lounge, and a front office. No one was hurt. Officials in Griffin told news outlets that multiple people had been trapped inside an apartment complex after trees fell on it. A hobby store lost part of its roof, and firefighters cut loose a man who had been pinned for hours under a tree that fell on his house. The city imposed a curfew from 10 p.m. Thursday to 6 a.m. Friday today. Nationwide, the Weather Service issued more than 40 separate tornado reports on Thursday, and Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky, South Carolina, and North Carolina all had tornado warnings for a time. The tornado reports were not yet confirmed, and some could be classified as wind damage once assessments are done. The tornado that hit Selma cut a wide path through the downtown area where brick buildings collapsed, oak trees were uprooted, cars were on their side, and power lines were left dangling. Plumes of thick black smoke from a fire rose over the city. Whether the storm caused the blaze wasn't immediately known. Selma Mayor James Perkins said no fatalities have been reported, but several people were seriously injured. Officials hope to get an aerial view of the city Friday morning. We have a lot of downed power lines, he said. There's a lot of danger on the streets. Maddie Moore was among Selma residents who picked up boxed meals offered by a charity downtown. "Thank God that we're here. It's like something you see on TV," Maddie Moore said of the destruction. A city of about 18,000 people, Selma is about 50 miles, that's 80 kilometers, west of Montgomery, the Alabama capital. It was a flashpoint of the civil rights movement where state troopers viciously attacked black people who marched nonviolently for voting rights across the Edmund Pettus Bridge on March 7, 1965. Melissa McVeigh took a video of the giant twister, which would turn black as it swept away home after home. "It would hit a house and black smoke would swirl up," Ms. McVeigh said. "It was very terrifying." Three factors, a natural La Nina weather cycle, warming of the Gulf of Mexico, likely related to climate change, and a decades-long eastward shift of tornado activity, combined to make Thursday's tornado outbreak unusual and damaging, said Victor Gensini, a meteorology professor at Northern Illinois University who studies tornado trends. La Nina, a cooling of parts of the Pacific that changes weather worldwide, was a factor in making a wavy jet stream that brought a cold front through, Gensini said. But that's not enough for a tornado outbreak. The other ingredient is moisture. Normally, the air in the southwest is fairly dry this time of year, but the dew point was twice normal, likely because of unusually warm water in the Gulf of Mexico, which is likely influenced by climate change, Gensini said. That moisture hit the cold front, adding up to killer storms. About 22,000 customers were without power in Atlanta, in Alabama, early Friday, according to PowerOutage.us, which tracks outages nationwide. In Georgia, about 23,000 customers remained without electricity after the storm system carved a path across a tier of counties just south of Atlanta. School was canceled for 90,000 students in at least six Georgia counties on Friday. In Kentucky, the Weather Service confirmed that an EF1 tornado struck Mercer County and said crews were surveying damage in a handful of other counties. And this report was from the Baltimore Sun. Martin reported from Woodstock, Georgia. Associated Press writers Alina Hartunian in Phoenix, Arizona, Jeff Amy in Atlanta, Seth Borenstein in Denver, Rebecca Reynolds in Louisville, Kentucky, Christopher Weber in Los Angeles, and photographer Butch Dill in Selma, Alabama, contributed to this report. Now, this, according to organizers of the annual celebration, will not stop the planned events, even though there are those who are hesitant to travel to Selma at this time, given the damage. Now we'll join a White House briefing that will include updates on what the White House intends to do regarding the damage in Selma, among other reports. So let's join Karine Jean-Pierre, White House Secretary, now.
Good afternoon, everybody. Okay, just two quick things at the top. We've seen the breaking news reports of the tornado damage in Selma. First, our hearts and thoughts go out to the Selma community and everyone impacted by the storm. Our team here is monitoring and assessing the situation and reaching out as appropriate to local and state officials to offer our support. And before I start and turn over to my colleague who is going to be giving you all a preview of the bilat that the President's going to have with the Japanese Prime Minister, and also do a preview of next Tuesday with the President's bilat with the Prime Minister of Netherlands, I just want to say a couple of things and make sure that everyone saw this. It's a statement from Richard Sauber. His statement reads, as the president said, he takes classified information and material seriously. And as we have said, we have cooperated from the moment we informed the archives that a small number of documents were found, and we will continue to cooperate. We have cooperated closely with the Justice Department throughout its review, and we will continue that cooperation with the special counsel. We are confident that a thorough review will show that these documents were inadvertently misplaced, and the president and his lawyers acted promptly upon discovering of this mistake. With that, my colleague is here, John Kirby, to talk through the bilat tomorrow and also with Japan, Prime Minister, and also the bilat with the Prime Minister of the Netherlands next Tuesday. And then I'll come back.
Afternoon, everybody. So I think tomorrow, you know, President Biden's going to be welcoming Prime Minister Kishida of Japan here to the White House. He's looking very much forward to that. Two leaders have already gotten to know each other quite well during in-depth discussions over the last year, Cambodia, the East Asia Summit, and in Tokyo for their bilateral meeting and the Quad Summit in May of 2022, as well as through their work together at the G7. Since taking office, President Biden has invested in our alliances to better equip us to collectively take on the 21st century challenges we face, whether that's the DPRK's pursuit of weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile and their ballistic missile program, China's assertiveness in the Indo-Pacific region and globally, or, of course, Russia's unprovoked war in Ukraine. Now, on each of these challenges, and on many more, Japan has proven a steadfast ally, ready to step up and do its part to advance our shared national security interests and values. Now, just let me set a little bit of the backdrop here for this particular visit. Last month, Prime Minister Kishida released Japan's new national security strategy and committed to boosting Japan's defense spending to 2% of their GDP. That includes investments in new defense capabilities, and that's a historic commitment by Japan. Prime Minister Kishida will arrive in Washington after a set of extensive discussions with European partners from Italy to the UK to France, of course, to Canada. And he and President Biden are going to have the opportunity to debrief on those discussions as well. And then, of course, yesterday, he saw the two foreign ministers and two defense ministers of our countries get together and announce some significant new improvements to the alliance. Upgrades, in fact, to U.S. force posture in Japan, which now include the stationing of a Marine Littoral Regiment in Okinawa, as well as advanced capabilities from intelligence collection analysis to anti-ship capabilities. But we modernized the alliance by announcing that attacks to, from, and within space could lead to the invocation of Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. Expanding bilateral exercises between our two countries and training, which includes in Japan's Southwest Islands. And, of course, deepening cooperation in the region to include trilateral training and exercises with Australia and increasing cooperation with the Republic of Korea on ballistic missile defense, anti-submarine warfare, maritime security. All these moves are not only going to strengthen our combined ability to defend Japan, but also will allow the United States and Japan together to provide for peace and security in the Indo-Pacific region and bolster deterrence in the region and globally. Now, I do think that tomorrow will also give President Biden an opportunity to discuss with Prime Minister Kishida progress that we're going to be able to make together in this coming year on a range of national security and economic issues. Japan, I think you know, holds the G7 presidency. They've just taken a seat on the UN Security Council. And while we're going to be hosting the APEC this year, as well as seeking to make swift progress on the Indo-Pacific economic framework, there's a lot of overlap there, and we're looking forward to that. We'll discuss how we're going to align these agendas going forward. So tomorrow's program, we expect, is going to be a full one. But from our perspective, the message is absolutely clear. Japan is stepping up and doing so in lockstep with the United States. Our investment in our alliances is paying huge dividends, and we look forward to celebrating that tomorrow. Speaking of alliances and partnerships, I'm also pleased to announce that next week President Biden will welcome Prime Minister Mark Rutte of the Netherlands to the White House on Tuesday the 17th to further deepen the historic ties between our two nations. As strong NATO allies and global partners. These two leaders are going to reaffirm our shared efforts to strengthen transatlantic security and economic prosperity. They'll discuss our steadfast support of Ukraine, and the Netherlands has been a very key supporter of security assistance in Ukraine. In fact, they've already provided $1 billion of that and are committing almost $3 billion committed, and committing almost $1 billion more going forward. They're going to be able to discuss all that cooperation going forward on critical technologies and a shared vision for a swift end to this war in Ukraine. They also plan to talk about a range of issues that are essential to strengthening democracy, whether that's respect for human rights, rules-based international order around the world, and including as co-hosts of the upcoming second Summit for Democracy. So a big week next week, too, with a very key ally and partner. We're looking forward to that.
Thank you, Clinton. John, I understand that the leaders will be focused on deterring the threat from China as well as other adversaries, including Russia, nuclear-powered adversaries, North Korea, Russia, China. But what would the leaders be thinking about in terms of this latest reaction, this latest announcement from South Korea, saying that they're open to acquiring nuclear weapons? Will President Biden and Prime Minister Kishida be focused on this? And does the administration believe that a nuclear South Korea contradicts U.S. policy of denuclearization in the entire peninsula?
The United States remains committed, President Biden remains committed, to the complete denuclearization of the peninsula. And that hasn't changed. The Republic of Korea has made clear that they are not seeking nuclear weapons. But what we are going to seek jointly together with them are improvements in extended deterrence capabilities. So we're going to move forward on that.
And while we have you here, Ukraine has confirmed that they will be receiving tanks from the UK as well as Poland. And during President Zelensky's visit, I think President Biden made it clear that the reason that the U.S. is not providing all the weapons that Ukraine is asking, including these kinds of, you know, tanks, is to ensure that the U.S. is avoiding an escalation to the war and ensuring NATO unity. Does the President believe that U.K. and Poland's decision to provide tanks to Ukraine will work against those goals?
The President fully supports those decisions, and those are sovereign decisions that those nations make about the kind of security assistance they provide. That's been the case throughout this entire length of the war. We respect that sovereignty, and we certainly are grateful for all the additional security assistance that nations are providing. I talked about the Netherlands. They provided air defense capabilities as well as howitzers. So we're grateful for that. But these are decisions that they have to make. The President believes. And these announcements, I think, reinforce this belief that there is terrific solidarity by the international community behind Ukraine and finding ways to support Ukraine. Just next week, Secretary of Defense will be hosting yet another contact group meeting over in Europe to contribute or find ways to contribute more security assistance from more partners. Those have been very, very successful. So the President believes that these, that all these decisions are actually mutually reinforcing of a larger issue here, and that is solid international community support behind Ukraine.
Oh, wow. I just to read that on the visit tomorrow. Is there going to be any more announcement outside of the defense aspects of this visit?
I'm not going to get ahead of the meeting that hasn't happened yet. I'll let the President summarize it. We'll have a readout afterward.
Thank you. Another defense question, since we have you here, John. An organization called Hostage Aid Worldwide has sent a letter to the President asking for a meeting with him regarding the hostages that have been held. Are dual nationals who've been held all over the world, but particularly in Iran. Until now, they have not got an answer. Do you know why the White House has not given them the attention that has been given to other hostages?
We take each case seriously, and we take each case individually. And just to be clear, dual national citizenship has nothing to do with it. If you have a blue passport, if you're an American citizen, whether you're a citizen of another nation or not, doesn't matter. That means you're going to be treated the same. All Americans are treated the same, regardless of whether they have citizenship in another nation. Paul Whelan's a great example of that. So we work each case individually, we work each case seriously, and we try to keep the families as informed as possible. I won't speak to specific meetings that have or have not occurred. when we get requests for meetings, we take those seriously too, and do the best we can to accommodate it. And certainly, we want to make sure that that in our communications with family members, that we are not doing or saying anything that actually makes it harder for us to establish a release mechanism for them. And you have to be mindful of that when you're in the public talking about these cases, that you've got to be careful that you're not putting anything out there in the public space that could make it harder. So each one is reviewed individually and sincerely. And if a meeting can be done and should be done, then we certainly will work to accommodate that.
Follow up with this letter?
I'm sorry?
Follow up with the letter that the...
We're familiar with the letter. I don't have a response to the letter for you. I wouldn't do that from the podium. We'll certainly respond appropriately.
Is Ridge Alconis on the agenda for tomorrow, John?
I won't get ahead of the president's discussion with Prime Minister Kushida James. We're certainly, the president is aware of lieutenant's circumstances in Japan, as is leadership across the military and the Defense Department. But I'm not going to, I won't preview or get ahead of the president's specific agenda.
Thank you so much. Can you give us your reaction, the president's reaction to reports that Russia is building up its forces in the east? What's the significance of that, and where do things stand in terms of potential effort to try to get the two sides to
sit down
at the table?
You mean the east of inside Ukraine?
Yeah.
Inside Ukraine.
Yes. And I have one more follow-up.
We've obviously been watching very closely military operations, particularly in the east of Ukraine, the Donbas area. And as I said, even from here in the briefing room, the violence, the fighting in areas around Bakhmut and now this town called Soledar has been significant and severe, and the fighting has been sharp between both sides. We've talked about in Bakhmut specifically, this is largely private military contractors. It's Mr. Prigozhin largely and the Wagner group that have been involved in much of the ground fighting there, but it has been vicious, and that's why going into the winter, knowing that the fighting isn't slowing down there, that we have been so focused on providing additional security assistance to Ukraine. Just last week, Ukraine announced for you, nearly $3 billion worth of systems, and there will be more coming, Kristen. I can't speak to Russian intent here or specific unit movements or what their goals are. I wouldn't presume to speak for the Russian Defense Ministry. I would just tell you that as they continue to literally throw bodies at the fighting in Bakhmut, because they have lost an extraordinary amount of largely convicts in this fighting. As they continue to do that, they need to know and understand that the United States, as well as our allies and partners, are going to continue to make sure that Ukraine can defend itself in that area and do so effectively. And I mean, I don't mean to belabor this, but look at the area, right? This is the Donbas area. We talked about this. It's a lot like Kansas. It's farmland. It's open ground. And so we want to make sure that we are providing the kinds of capabilities to Ukraine to be able to succeed in that environment. That's why Bradley fighting vehicles were part of the package that Karine announced. That's why the Pentagon will very soon be DOD and our allies will be starting some combined arms maneuver training outside of Ukraine for up to battalion-level units of the Ukrainian armed forces to help them in this fight.
Can I just try one more? We're going to direct 99% of our questions about the classified documents.
It would be okay with me if it was
100%. I do have one for you. Has there been an assessment about any potential national security risk of having these classified documents in the president's private think tank here in Washington and in Delaware?
That would be a question for the Justice Department, because they are conducting a review now. You saw that they've announced a special counsel. That issue would be for them to speak to.
Can you speak broadly to the national security concerns about having classified documents in private spaces?
The president has spoken to how seriously he takes the handling of classified documents, and he, as somebody who's aware of the process myself, did exactly the right thing, which is to have them immediately turned over. And that's where this appropriately lies. And again, the Justice Department would be the place to go to answer your question.
One question on Japan, and maybe one on Ukraine. On Japan, are they going to be discussing the semiconductor exports to China and efforts to restrict those exports? Is that going to be a topic? And is this Do you see this as very important to have a country like Japan join those efforts to have some sort of chip control, if not a ban, but to have efforts in that area to control?
Yeah, I want to be careful not to get ahead of President Biden. I think, as I alluded to, it's going to be a very full and robust agenda. But I think it's safe to say that when it comes to issues he discusses routinely with his counterparts bilaterally and in multilateral settings, supply chains, resilient supply chains to include with respect to high technology is always a part of the discussion. But I won't, again, get ahead of what they're going to say.
And on Ukraine, I know you've said many times you don't want to talk about the intent of the Russians, but what do you make?
It's not that I don't want to. I can't. I mean,
the new assignment, if you could call it, of Valery Gerasimov, and what does that say maybe about the Russian strategy as he's been named the new man in charge of the war effort?
You know, they've gone through quite a few leadership changes, haven't they, now in 10.5 months? Again, I think Karine said this very well yesterday. We'll let the Kremlin speak to their decision-making here. But they've gone through a lot of leadership changes, clearly in an effort, almost from very early on, in an effort to overcome the sorts of difficulties they've had in this war, difficulties which remain, whether that's logistics and sustainment, ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, the ability to gather information, to communicate, command and control between units, certainly unit morale and cohesion, and without a doubt, I mean, just look at what's been going on in the last couple of weeks, battlefield performance. So interesting that they have now gone back to Gerasimov, who was the charge at the very beginning. Who is essentially the chief of their army staff, not an operational commander. It's an interesting selection. I think, you know, they should speak to that. But I think it's indicative and shows the degree to which the Russians continue to struggle to get it right in terms of just leadership, command, and control problems.
Hey, Maria. Thank you so much. I had a question. Like, tensions are rising against between Sweden and Turkey. How confident are you that these two countries can resolve these tensions? And how confident are you that Sweden would be able to join NATO's tour? And I would have a
problem. We firmly support their ascension. I think you know that. President Biden's made that very, very clear. So too does the vast majority of NATO nations. I'll certainly let those two nations speak for themselves in terms of the discussions that they're having. You saw yesterday Swedish officials said publicly that they believe that these discussions are actually on a positive track, and we certainly hope that's the case.
And on the classified documents, have there been, you know, any other countries in touch with the administration expressing some kind of concerns about how secure classified documents are and how, like, confidential information about those countries could have circulated?
I'm not aware of any such discussions or concerns.
Alex, come back.
Thank you. The family and supporters of Russian dissident Alexei Navalny are increasingly concerned about his health. In fact, even Russian doctors are openly putting their name to a letter.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can do to let the Kremlin know that
we share the concerns and continue to believe that he should be immediately released, obviously, and short of that, to insist that he gets proper medical care. So we've shared those concerns, and we'll continue to make plain those concerns to Russian authorities.
And that was a report from the White House on matters of international security and decisions made regarding the war between Russia and Ukraine. That's all for now. You've been listening to On Air Daily News. This is Naima Latif, and we invite you to join us every Monday through Friday, 1 p.m. Central, 2 p.m. Eastern, and wherever you are in the world, adjust your time so you can hear us live. Feel free to call in during our newscast to report your good news at 515-605-9749. We keep you informed in what's happening across the world, across the water, and across the street that can affect your life. Until Monday, Enjoy the rest of your day and week.